I'm really glad that we have this opportunity to do this because for some reason we have not done this in Radio Land. This is the first time we've actually had a conversation longer than 5 minutes.
Exactly.
So, how long had you known Nora Ephron? You'd never worked with her before, had you?
No, I never worked with her before. I knew her around the time that I was running The Public, and she would always come to Shakespeare in the Park, and we had tons of mutual friends, and that was that. And then Colin Callender called me up, who I'd worked with at HBO, said he had this play, and he sent it to me, and it was by Nora, and I was instantly sort of caught up in it because it was my New York, in the sense that I moved here in 79, 80, and it was set at
your youth as well as
my youth, exactly. I was four at the time, and so yeah, I was really jazzed by sort of the testosterone of the world, and that she had written it, and she knew the world so specifically, and then I guess it was. Then we started working in September, and she would come to my house once a week, and we'd work on the play, and we went through various drafts of it. We did a workshop in January with Tom Hanks and Courtney Vance, who was also nominated for a Tony.
Was working with somebody who was also a director a different, better, worse experience than working with a writer, as you worked with many as a director? Is it different?
No, I mean, Nora had an incredible series of skill sets. I mean, I would talk to her about, I'd say, this needs to go and this needs to go, and she would say brilliantly, I'm sure you're 100% right, George, but I am not prepared to say goodbye to that. And then we'd move on to the next thing. I mean, her skills of deflecting were just incredibly brilliant. And but at the same time, what was really fascinating is I would give her tons and tons and tons of notes, and she would take them, and I would say, take your time. And then she'd be back a week later or a week and a half later with a new draft. And I was at the time, I was sort of dazzled, and I was sort of frustrated. Breathe with it. But as it turns out, she was working at a very different timetable.
Because she was sick.
She was sick, and it was, and I didn't know this, and a finite number of people knew it. But there was just the ferocity and the discipline and the rigor that she approached the work was just astonishing.
One thing the play is about, as you're suggesting, is a different era in New York that seems, even though it's only 15 years ago, 20 years ago, a period piece. When newspapers had nothing to worry about and this kind of old-fashioned 20th century Irish guys in the bar,
as one of the characters says. Or there's one of these wonderful lines that when the character McAlary, he is arguing with his editor, he says, "No, Stanley, I'm writing it for tomorrow." And it was like, no, it's going to be in the tomorrow edition. And the ferocity of which he was approaching it is just fascinating because there is no tomorrow. There is 5 seconds later. And that sense of craftsmanship and this sense of go out and get it and then hanging out in a world that's about the boys. I remember at one point I asked Nora one of the things of what this play was about, and she said it's about hanging out in the bar with the guys. What's better? It is a celebration of what was.
Now you were stuck though with an actor who had never done Broadway and hadn't done theater in 30 years.
Yeah.
How was working with Tom Hanks?
Well, Tom's ridiculously smart. I mean, and he isn't just an actor, but he's also a producer. And so anytime that he would approach the material, and I mean, there were Nora and I would work, and then every say 2 or 3 months, Tom would come in, and then we go through and we talk about things, and Nora would privately lobby him about things she wanted to keep, and I'd lobby him about things I wanted to go, and then he had his own agenda, and it was really great.
Was his agenda making the character McAlary more likable?
I don't think so. I think it was just making it clearer. You know, actors are always just trying to burrow down and find the truth that's underneath the truth that's underneath the truth, so that therefore they can live inside of something for 8 shows a week. It's very easy to do a shallow version of a character if you have three or four performances. But eight shows a week, it's gotta you've gotta find another truth that's underneath the obvious truth if you're going to be able to sustain yourself, and it's going to be fun or interesting and fascinating. So that was the process. Also, I think fundamentally when I got on board, the play was called Stories About McAlary. And it was a lot of people telling stories about McAlary. And in many respects, I think the process of the working was changing it from stories about McAlary to Lucky Guy and figuring out how McAlary was the center of not just the stories, but the center of the play.
So the script you got at the beginning was very different than the script that is being performed today.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very different than the script that we ended up through the working process with
right.
Nora. Yeah, it was, you know, I'm sorry.
So she died last July, end of June, 9 months before you're supposed to open. Were you done? Was it okay in a professional sense that okay, I've got?
I think it was more than okay. I think it was very. It was. I mean, because there were. I mean, we had a theater. We had actors. I was talking with designers. So it wasn't a sketch. It was a full play that we had worked on with an incredible level of rigor. And Tom had committed. Tom was connected to the project, but he fully committed, okay, I'll do this. I'll stop my life and reconfigure it so I can do this play about a month and a half earlier. So there was, it was very much so a play. And the rehearsal process without Nora was fascinating and challenging because she was so ridiculously organized. She had conducted all these interviews, and she had various drafts. I remember at one point, I was looking for something, and one line didn't feel right. And it was at one point McAlary was talking about one of the editors at the newspaper had violated him, and he said, "Catherine Ellis, I helped her mother find a caretaker. I was blah 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 blah." And then I found an earlier draft where he said, "Catherine Ellis, I got her moved from sports onto Metro." So I kept on finding rewrites of Nora. Nora kept on rewriting Nora, and it was really fascinating. It was like this archives was passed on in some strange way. I felt like the time that we spent and the rigor of the time that we spent was in preparation
for having to do it
for having to do it without her. I mean, it's the and the parallels that it was fascinating dynamic that she read McAlary's obituary and went, "This will be a great play." McAlary was on his way to interview Abner Louima, which was his crowning case when he was on chemo. Nora started, about the time that she started work with me, started chemo,
working
on this play.
And so this other authorial subtext was entirely invisible to you.
It completely.
And to Tom Hanks. And
to everybody, but it was being played out. And it was very interesting. On opening night, there were all these projections, and then opening night, as part of the curtain call, we on the projections we added Nora's picture, and when we did in rehearsal, we turn around, we point, everything was fine, and then in the moment of opening night and the cumulative dynamic of working on the play, because we went into rehearsal January 14th, all of a sudden this technical thing became instantly rawly emotional. And it overwhelmed everybody. It's just fascinating how you compartmentalize things so that you can do the job.
You kept yourself from being emotional.
Exactly, because that wasn't my job. My job to be emotional. It was my job to do work with these actors, to realize this play, to capture this world, and to engage an audience. And
so,
then when it was free to, all this feeling was there.
So your New York began in the 80s when you were here. Rewind further. I read that your first visit, I guess, to New York when you were a kid in Kentucky, your mother brought you here when you were 13 to visit New York?
Well, she was doing some advanced degree work at NYU, and she brought me along. And I was theater obsessed. So I got to see, I saw Pearl Bailey and Hello, Dolly. I saw a revival of West Side Story at the State Theater. And interestingly
That's
enough.
That's a good visit.
It was a very good visit. So I came back. It was... I also saw a mobile theater production that Joe Papp had directed of Hamlet with Cleavon Little.
Wow.
In Washington Square Park.
Wow.
And in many respects, I have a feeling my aesthetic evolved that trip. You know, I remember watching the quintet in West Side Story just before the rumble happens, and it was a very stark stage, and there were fragments of scenery, and there was the Jets and the Sharks, and there was Anita and Maria and Tony, and they were all in different worlds, but they were all on stage, and the audience totally was telling the story and involved in the story. And so that sense of starkness and the suggestive nature of the less you do, the more an audience is engaged, instantly caught up with me. I was sort of dazzled by the pure showmanship of Hello, Dolly. Not a deep work, but incredibly polished.
Yeah.
Pure manifestation of showmanship. And I remember the rawness of what the mobile unit was and the real groundlings of New York City watching this play and this incredibly raw exchange of energy. And I think in some respects, I've spent my entire life putting all three things together.
Really? So yeah. That was the moment when you said, well, I'm not even 13 yet, but this is the life I want?
No, I think I said that earlier. Yeah. I mean, I remember watching. I mean, this is my mother would be incredibly embarrassed. I remember. Well, first, I wanted to have a giant amusement park, and when I remember about 5 or 6, and I'm going, well, actors make a lot of money, so I'll become an actor, and so I can have all this money, so I can build this amusement park. I even have the plans.
You wanted to be Michael Jackson?
I wanted to be Walt Disney. You know, mine is the fascistic impulses, but I, and I remember very consciously practicing starving so that when I came to New York, I would know how to be a starving actor. You know?
That's the cutest thing I've ever heard.
It wasn't cute. It was true. I mean, and the unfortunate thing, when you get here, it doesn't take practice, you know, so you find out these things.
But you didn't come here immediately. You get out of high school in Kentucky and end up going to the very prestigious Pomona College.
Yes.
In Southern California.
Yes.
Why did you go to that coast instead of coming right away to this one?
Because I was tired of cold weather. And I went, I'm going somewhere warm that has a great theater program. And I got accepted to Northwest. I got accepted to a bunch of East Coast schools that said, no, we're tired of the cold weather. We're going out there. We're going to be warm for a while. And it turned out to be perfect. It turned out to be perfect.
And then you made your assault on New York, and everything worked out well.
It worked out well, yes. It was a journey. I mean, at first, after college, I moved to L.A. to do theater there. And it was I did it for about 3 years. And then I remember, I was doing plays, and I got a couple of good reviews in the L.A. Times, and I was writing and directing them, and then I remember I was interviewed to write for a sitcom. I was maybe 23 or 24, and in the meeting, the head writer said, oh, he's quick, we're going to have to tie one hand behind his back. And I saw them literally doing that, and that's when I said, okay, I'm moving to New York. So I moved to New York when I was about, I don't know, 24, something
like
that.
The alternative history of George Wolfe as Hollywood sitcom writer is an interesting
yes,
one.
Yeah, yes, exactly, exactly.
But you were, as I think a lot of people don't know, a successful, you were a writer before
yes.
you were really a director.
Yes.
I mean, with the Clark Museum, then as you directed Jelly's Last Jam, you also wrote that
book. Yeah.
The Wild Party,
yeah.
You wrote the book. What was there a moment, though, so you know you can do this, but was there a moment when you were young, you said, no, I'm better at this auteurist directorial command thing than I am as a writer?
No, I think that, I mean, when I came to New York, I identified myself as a writer or director, and they said, you can't do that.
Right.
You're not allowed to do, you can't do both. So I said, okay, well, let me focus on being a writer, and then I, as luck would have it, I ended up having a writing career, and then I went back, and then I directed something, which was Spunk, which ended up also at the Public Theater, and then, because I started out, I was the book writer for Jelly's Last Jam. Jerry Zaks was the original director. Hmm. By this time I started directing, and so I ended up inadvertently becoming the writer and the director. And then sort of the directing career just sort of ate everything else. And then right after I did Jelly, I got offered Angels. And then in the middle of Angels, I got offered the Public. So, and then that was that. So in many respects, I'm trying to reclaim some of my writer self, which I will.
Back to the Public, when you're just a kid and you're new to New York, I read that you're barely out of NYU and you go and meet with Joe Papp, and he says, George, I'll give you a black theater here at the Public Theater. And he said, nah, I'm not interested.
Well, this was after, it wasn't, well, word that it happened that way. I left NYU and they went, hi, George, come on in. It didn't quite happen like that.
Yeah.
After the Colored Museum, he offered me my own theater inside the institution. He said, "You can do all these. It can be a black theater. You can do it." And I said, "I'm more interested in how cultures and worlds collide
rather than being the black theater."
Exactly. Or compartmentalization just didn't seem, it didn't seem as interesting to me then. Because I didn't see where the world is and where the world is going. It's, purity doesn't exist. And I was intrigued by cultural collisions and what happens when this culture smashes up against this and sometimes certain political and things can happen that can be scary, and other times certain cultural things can happen and can be astonishing. And so that was much more fascinating to me instead of an absolute.
So you ran. You were. There was another director after Joe Papp before you of the public theater. But you were the next long time. Mm-hmm. 11 years you ran the thing. Mm-hmm. First of all, did you leave just because you thought, okay, there should be a term limit, and I've come to the end, or why did you?
It's one of the things. I mean, when I took the job, I thought I was going to be there for 4 years, literally, and then it went on. And then I thought that I don't think anybody should be in charge of anything for longer than 10 years because. How can you protect yourself from making it not be about you?
Yeah, except CEOs of
100%, absolutely.
It doesn't apply to.
Absolutely. So I. And also I missed being private. I would read things only for the purpose of gaining the information that I needed to do what I needed to do. I would read information just for a project that I was working on. Everything was an end goal, and I felt like I couldn't luxuriate inside of my own creative process. Everything had an agenda.
Right.
So I missed visiting my brain and my own sort of creative confusion and living inside of, because I think when you live inside of a dormant period, it's when you're really creating. And when you have to deliver all the time, it's an interesting, challenging muscle. But after a while, it becomes goal-oriented as instead of process.
Yeah, I hear you. And one of the things you said when you left the public is, I want to direct motion pictures.
Yeah.
And some people took that as like, oh, he's going to be a movie director now. What was your thinking, and how has that, you've made a great movie for television, you made a feature, you have a new feature coming out. How has that been? What have you learned about your own skills and temperament doing that versus directing theater?
I love the collaborative nature. Theater, you're locked in a room with these people. I remember at one point I was doing a show and I was working with a really gifted film actor, actress. It was actually, and I said something, and she got really mad, and she stormed off. And then 3 seconds later, she came back because there was no trailer to go to. I mean, literally, I heard this, and then it was like, okay, what are you saying? And then we continued the conversation. And there's something about the compression of being in the room all the time, over and over and over, that is such an intricate part of the energy that makes a theatrical event work. I'm really intrigued. I was really fascinated by the compartmentalization of working on a film project. And also one of the things I think is really fascinating, when you work on a play, one's obsessions can only go so far because your obsession is about a moment being right or being perfect must create a space so that the actor can claim it and it's theirs. I always tell actors my ultimate goal as a director is to make it look like it's springing forth from them. And that phenomenon, so you have to negotiate how much you can obsess about material versus empowering them to claim it. In film, there's no end to how much you can obsess.
Right.
There is no end to, no, that glass needs to be, okay, perfect. You know what I mean?
Even when it's shot.
Even when it's shot.
As you cut it.
Exactly. And to me, and I kept on doing this film, edit film, film to theater dictionary. And to me, the editing process is the real rehearsal process. It's where you really build the nuance of performance.
In film.
So you get as much stuff out there as you possibly can. And then in the editing room, you're crafting moments and details. So it's fun. I mean, I realize I like living in both worlds.
And do you feel as though, because you are relatively newer to it, both in time and you've done fewer films mm-hmm. and you have pieces of theater, is that exciting because you don't know what you're doing quite as fully?
Well, I would phrase it differently.
The challenge of feeling like a virgin, okay?
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that in some respects, I haven't done very many revivals of plays because, I mean, it's a finite number because I like not knowing. I like, if something scares me or intrigues me or like, you know, how I come do Angels in America, how the hell do you do a 7-hour play? You know what I mean? Really? I mean, if there's something that scares me, then I'm engaged, or something that there's so that there's so kind of so because I feel as though I have the skill set. I know how to work with actors. I think I can be generally very, very smart about material. I know how to talk to designers. I know how to talk to a bunch of people. So I have the confidence of the skill set, but then I like throwing myself into the unknown of it all. And because I know that when I, at the end of that experience, I'm going to end up with additional muscles that I didn't have before. So I think unquestionably there is this wow equation of film that I really love. But I feel that same thing about Lucky Guy. Oh my God, this play has the rhythms of a film. How am I going to craft that? How am I going to do that? I love not knowing. I love not knowing because through the journey, I'm going to end up clearer or cleaner or sharper, hopefully.
In the late 90s, and I didn't, I thought you'd had this just perfectly smooth path full of praise, success, Tony's awards, and the rest. As I was researching for tonight, you had 18 months of just the worst couple of years I've ever heard about. You not only had a couple of difficult shows you were getting to Broadway, The Wild Party and On the Town, mm-hmm. which is the least of it, as it turns out. Your mother died, mm-hmm. your house burned down, your kidney failed, and got your brother gave you one of his, mm-hmm. all in this very short period of time. Mm-hmm. So that must not have been good. But my question is, did you feel like, it sounds like this set of experiences that could have transformed somebody. Did you feel like a different artist, a different person in 1999 than you did in 1996?
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, the thing which I hate is when a play you do is really, really, really successful, what you learn is how to be successful. You know, and when you come into contact with an obstacle, very frequently, I don't care if the obstacle is personal or professional, it's where you build the muscles for the next beat of your life. So, in summary, it's what you described. It sounds pretty horrible, but it was really interesting because at the time I remember very specifically I was running the public, I was creating Noise Funk during the morning. In the evenings I was rehearsing The Tempest, which was moving from the Delacorte to Broadway, and then on my days off I would fly down to Houston to sit with my mother who was dying. And it was an incredibly intense time, but in many respects, I realized the only place I felt safe was in a rehearsal room because my world was being redefined, and that safety resulted in Noise Funk. That's where I was able to release the joy because I wasn't feeling a lot of joy in my life, and the joy was what was released in the creation of that. So in the middle of this, I helped to make something that I thought was really beautiful. And at the same time, while I was encountering It was interesting because I'm an incredibly strong-willed person. And interestingly enough, it took my kidney not working for me to realize that I needed to redefine my relationship with my own body. You know, and it was...
You mean not treat it as badly as...
Well, you need to just go, okay, now we're doing this, come on, body. And now we're doing this, okay, come on, body. Okay, come on, and not listening to it whatsoever. And my brother went, hey, need a kidney? And it was, you know, and it was... And it's a miracle. I'm walking around with somebody's organ in my body, and it's been 15 years. So I feel like it was a horrifying time, but it was in some respects a peculiarly blessed time because I was able to shed stuff that I needed to shed. I was able to develop a cleaner sense of why I was doing what I was doing. And
you're here to talk about it.
And I'm here to talk about it. And and honor, you know, the gift of what my brother did, and honor, you know, my mother gave me New York when I was 13. You know, she delivered me here. She opened up the way. It was very interesting because every single time my mother was redefining herself, she brought me along. She stopped working when she had my older brother and sister, and then when she went back to work, she was working in a library. She was pregnant with me, and then she went to teach at this private black grade school in Kentucky, and she brought me along. And then at one point, when she went to get her doctorate at Miami University in Ohio, she brought me along, and I went through a period of 13 or 14 where I was really shy. And I joined a theater company, and I reclaimed my command of who I was. So every single time that she was redefining her boundaries, she was giving me, in many respects, my future.
Do you believe, either consciously or not, when she brought you here when you were 13, that she knew what she was doing, that she knew that this is where little George was going to make his life?
I don't know about that, but she knew I loved and was, I loved and was obsessed with theater for as long as I can remember. So I'm sure that was somewhere that was delivering, you know.
Yes.
And then when I said, hi, I want to do theater for a living, then she and my father shrieked and were in horror. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, even though they had encouraged every single creative impulse in my life, I said, it doesn't work that way. You don't get to applaud me and then say no when I say I'm going in that direction.
Yeah.
So,
looking at all the things you've directed, do you have a sense of what fraction were great, what fraction were good, okay, and what fraction you'd like to take off the CV?
No. I've done some great stuff. I mean, it's like,
right.
I've been in the room with some really great. I was in the room with Tony Kushner on parts one and two of Angels in America, and then Caroline or Change.
For sure, those would be in the great.
Great. I was in the room with Elaine Stritch on Elaine Stritch at Liberty. I was in the room with Susan Laurie Parks on Top Dog Underdog, and she won the Pulitzer from it. I was in the room with the incredibly insane, brilliant Larry Kramer on The Normal Heart last year. I was in the room with Nora Ephron. I've been in the room with, really, I was in the, with the sort of tap genius of Savion Glover. I've been in the room with really, really great, smart people, and they've asked me to be in the room because they felt I could help them shape or build what they were doing. So I don't...
None you regret?
No, because I think you only regret if you don't know why you were in the room in the first place. And in every single instance, regardless of how it turned out, I always knew why I was in the room. And I was there to either nurture something or to figure out something. So regardless, it's not the degree of the applause. I mean, it really is. It's the danger of the journey. It's the excitement of putting yourself in a space where you're fighting to make something that will hopefully empower the people who see it. So I'm not a big regret guy because I think it pisses on what you learned.
Right. So your designer on Lucky Guy, our mutual friend David Rockwell, has designed a new museum in Atlanta called the National Center for Civil and Human Rights, of which you are the chief creative officer.
Ooh, yes.
What does that mean?
It means that, in a very specific way, I'm involved in the crafting of the telling of the civil rights story, specifically in the South, Atlanta-centric, but not exclusively. And then I'm involved in overseeing all the other various visual and storytelling equations that exist in the center. A wonderful, smart woman named Jill Savitt is involved in the human rights equation. So it's my sort of uber artistic vision that is at play and in service of the telling of these stories.
Is it hard is part of your thinking about it and the choices you're making of how not to make it conventionally hagiographic about certain civil rights figures, how do you tell that story in a way that isn't the version of the story we've heard a lot?
Well, one of the things that was astonishing, because I mean, I'm from Frankfort, Kentucky, and for the first 8 years of my life, my town was segregated, and Martin Luther King
really until 62 or so, yeah.
Something like that, yeah, and Martin Luther King marched through Frankfort, Kentucky, and my grandmother took me out of school when we marched, and to me, it was all these big guys and all these big grown women. And then as I started doing research, I realized how incredibly, ridiculously young they were. And to me, that's what it's about. And that's what it's connected. I'm really intrigued by stories, it could be theater or movies or whatever, about one person standing. You know, the normal heart was... In many respects, I was starting to become very cynical about New York theater. I'd done a play that I thought was mesmerizing by John Greer called Free Man of Color that I completely and totally love. And it was like, yeah, I think it's a masterpiece and it will be acknowledged as that it's one day. So then, through a series of circumstances, I ended up working on and ended up directing The Normal Heart. And living inside that play was so empowering for me. And we did it in an insane amount of time, because people responded with a passion and an emotion, and that was thrilling to me. So I went, oh, you can do something that matters and can have an impact on Broadway. Oh yeah, I believe again. So that was very important for me. But also, it was the story of one person standing up and saying no. One person saying no, and then they look across the room, and another person is saying no. And then another person says no, and then all of a sudden you're changing the world. And those stories, and I'm drawn to things that are about empowering people. So when I first started thinking about this museum, I wasn't interested in creating a memorial to what was. I wasn't interested in creating people who are my age and older. My target was 14-year-old knuckleheads who know nothing, who have know absolutely nothing about this story, and realizing that people all over this country, all over the world, would see something on TV or on the news and go, I've got to be involved. And to me, that's what I want to do. I want to create that sense of that you can, in fact, you can see something and you can speak up. One of the things that was really fascinating, around the time of Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat, I found out there was this young girl named Claudette Cloven, who was 15, Rosa Parks did what she did in December. Claudette Cloven did what she did in March of the same year. She was 15 years old, and she refused to give up her seat. She was arrested, and they were planning. It was a women's organization was planning the boycott, and they hadn't got their organization quite together. And also, Claudette was a 15-year-old girl, and she wasn't exactly the perfect poster person for the movement. So they waited and they organized it, and then Rosa Parks did in December. It was the perfect time, and they didn't move forward there. But a 15-year-old girl said, no, we're not doing this. And those kinds of stories, and finding those stories the civil rights movement was filled with incredibly eloquent, powerful people, and then there was filled with extraordinary, ordinary people. There was this woman, and I'm going to forget her name, Viola, I'm going to forget her last name, and she was from Michigan, and and she watched something. She was an Italian woman, and she had seen something on TV, and she went down there to help transport people in one of the marches. And on the way back, she was driving back, and the Klan had followed her, and they just shot her. And it was a mother of three. And she saw them, and she said, I'm engaged. I got to go do something. And just those stories of triumph and empowerment and taking on, that's what I want to try to celebrate. And I was very determined. I want to try to create a situation where it has the intellectual rigor of a museum, the sort of visceral potency of what theater can do. Mm-hmm. One of the things really fascinating about the sit-ins is that they would go through rigorous training. They would go to these workshops where they would sit there and people would yell insults at them and throw things at them so that they could be focused and very disciplined while they were doing it. And they were also, there was a big obsession about being immaculately, perfectly dressed. So you're sitting there at a counter and these insane young hooligans are behind you doing things. So who's the barbarian and who's the civilized thing? The civil rights movement was acutely aware of image. So one of the things that we've created an interactive thing where you place your hands on a counter and sonically you're going to have on these earphones, which is going to create sonically the impact of people yelling and assaulting you. Mm. And if you lift your hands, you start to lose points. So engaging in a game so you begin to understand the rigor and the discipline and the focus that is required. So try to take this story that we know and make it new and fresh and engaging so that people can get it in a real way and hopefully be engaged and empowered by it.
Well, your 14-year-old knuckleheads, as well as myself, will love that.
Exactly. There you go.
That sounds
exactly
great. Before I open up the questions to the audience, if anybody has some questions, I have one final question for you, which is, you hate eating because you think you were poisoned in a past life?
Oh, my God, I don't believe you. Yes. I don't know. I was a very impressionable child, needless to say, with me starving so I could practice starving. I remember seeing something on an Alfred Hitchcock Presents in which the relatives were trying to poison a little boy and feed him poison mushrooms so that they could get his money. And so anytime my mother, I would tell this to my mother, go, don't tell people that, that's not true, you will love. Anytime my parents would feed me mushrooms, I went, they're trying to kill me. I mean, it was the storyteller who didn't have a place to tell stories.
Mm. Well, just before I open up for questions, my elder sister fed my elder brother poisonous toadstools to poison him. So you...
Hey!
Who knows what was going on there in Frankfurt?
Who knows what was going on? Really, exactly.
If we have any questions, now is the time to ask them. And I guess we have a microphone here. Yes.
Hi, my name is Noelle Simone Whippler, and I was very inspired by your story. And myself, I'm an actress and a vocalist myself, mm-hmm. and growing up in Harlem. And I wanted to know if you're currently going to do any more theater.
Go ahead, what, I'm sorry?
If you're going to do more theater here in New York City.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, periodically I will go, I don't do anything, yeah, of course, absolutely, I go, well, Sarah, but, I love it, I'm wired to do it. I think the piece of me that loves community is, the question you're asking, the piece of me that loves community is the director inside of me, and the piece of me that's a hermit is the writer side of me, and so theater is my chance to be a part of a community and make something and share it with another community that comes in at nightly. So it's intrinsic to who I am. So yes, I'll continue to do so.
A community where you're the enlightened despot.
Where I am in service of the story being told.
Oh, okay.
And can I give you my card?
Sure, why not? Yes.
Right here?
Yeah.
Right
here. Okay. someone right here. This comes right here.
But they're taping it, so we want your voice on tape, I guess.
When you were directing that memorable scene where the Mormon mother says, "Are you a hairdresser?" And he says, "Madam, it would be your lucky day if I was." Was that the kind of cultural colliding that you were talking about?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, Angels in America, it was my second show on Broadway, and it was what was really fascinating about that show. On part one, I was given sacred text. It was completely and totally written, and on part two, I received a script 2 weeks before we went into rehearsal. It was 5 acts. And through the course of the rehearsal process, 2/3 of that changed. So and I was in heaven. You know, I was in heaven because it was very interesting because I didn't get to experience the Angels of America that everybody else experienced because I was in the middle of it. But every day, Tony was coming in with sort of new, wonderful stuff. The character of Belize was being changed daily, and there's this brilliant scene. I will never forget the first day. There's this brilliant scene where the character Belize, the black gay nurse, shares his vision of heaven with Roy Cohen, who is dying, and the character Roy Cohen says, "And now heaven," and Belize goes, "Roy, that was heaven." You know, and it was so wonderful. So it was a thrilling journey because every day it was crazy and maddening and wonderful. And it was, you know, I love working with Tony.
Even though he rewrites.
Yeah, I mean, at the recent version of that they did of Perestroika, he went, "I did a little bit of work on it." I was like,
"Hi, with Lucky Guy." So I believe there's still a handful of the characters who are still living, and I'm curious if you engaged with any of them. And what your feelings are in general about engaging with real-life characters that are being represented on the stage, the pros and cons of that.
I did not. The actors did. I mean, I will go backstage, and Eddie Hayes is sitting with the actor playing Eddie Hayes. I mean, they hang out. You know, Dwyer is hanging out with the actor playing Dwyer. When we were in the rehearsal process, I strongly encouraged the actors to not connect with the real people until they had found their way. So then I said, because I want you to claim who these people are based on what you see on the page. And then once you feel as though you've got that muscle going, then you can connect. And some of them have formed these really intense relationships. It was also very interesting. Very early on, I had dinner with Alice McAlary, which is Mac's wife. And it's complicated because one of the things which I think Nora... One of the things which I love about the play is the character of John Cotter says, you know, there's only one real truth. The real truth is, who's telling the story? Who is telling the story? And it becomes complicated because I had people come up to me and say, McAlary was a bastard. He was horrible. He was terrible. He was a charlatan. He was this. Somebody else come up to me and say, McAlary was astonishing. He was heroic. He paved the way for me. And so it's I wanted to protect myself, and I wanted to protect the actors from that. There was one actor in Normal Heart who spoke to one of the characters it was based on, and it undermined their confidence in such an incredibly specific way. They continued to do really, really, really brilliant work, but they were torn between the character they were playing and obeying a real person. And a real person is 80 times more complicated than what you're going to play. So that was my first warning sign, but no, I avoid it.
That's interesting. We have time for another question or two right here.
Hi, George.
Hi.
So you really described that your life is really formed around the intersection and collisions of cultures and the stories that they result in and the political, you know, things that occur as a result as well. And I'm just curious, you know, this is the space where we explore that constantly at WMIC. And what do you see today as the cultural collisions that you would dream about directing plays and sharing the stories about in the future?
It's not now, but I'm working. I find myself. I don't really know why. I'm working on two projects about former Yugoslavia. One that's set in Belgrade at the rise of Milosevic, and another project that's set in Sarajevo over in 44, 48, and then 90, this one project. I don't know. I spent Thanksgiving in Belgrade 3 years ago. There's something I've been living inside of that project, one of which I wrote, and I don't know, and I'm obsessed, and it's not contemporary, but I'm really obsessed with the phenomenon of I'm living next door to you. Somebody comes into power, says some inflammatory things because they're not very good at being leaders, and that gives me permission to now hate you and kill you. I'm really intrigued by that. I'm also in one of the projects. The project is set in Belgrade. It was about a radio station called B92 that these young kids started just before Milosevic came to power, and it was going to be the first free radio station there. And then Milosevic came to power and imposed all these rules, and when they were required to read state-issued news, they would underscore it with Rage Against the Machine or Fight the Power. Mm. So the music became the soundtrack of truth that was going on underneath the news that was lying. And so that's one of the projects that I really, really love. But some reason I find myself, I don't know, I went through a period where I was stuck in the 20s. Now I'm stuck in former Yugoslavia. So because there's just, that story is resonating. Those stories are resonating with me right now in a very, very strong way that I don't really completely understand.
Are those theater projects or film projects?
Both are film projects, yeah. Good luck getting those going, yeah.
last question.
Okay.
Given your relationship with Tony Kushner with Angels and Caroline, would you possibly be working with him again? I would anticipate that you
would. We are talking about doing something together.
It's about Croatia?
Once he writes it. So that could be
years.
Decades. So no, but we're talking about that. And there's an old project. There's an old project that we were going to do together that we also might be doing, but we'll see. And then there was a third thing that I think is going on, which might happen sooner. Yeah.
George Wolf, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.